Hey folks, my name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual, hormonal, and genitourinary health, and I'm coming at you from Grapevine, Texas, the Sexual Medicine Society of North America. That's a mouthful. Conference this year, and I have this whole team of researchers with me who are going to talk about their research, and they're kind of part of this Baylor Consortium. And why this is so near and dear to my heart is, like, way back in the day, I mean, not that long ago, I was a medical student at Baylor College of Medicine. I worked with Larry Lipschultz and Mo Kira, and they built the foundation for why I am so passionate about sexual health and hormone health. And it's like, I feel like we're all kindred spirits, right? So we're going to kind of go around here, and each one of them is going to introduce themselves and talk to you about why the research they're doing matters, not only to them and their patients, but to you all watching. Hit it.
All right. Hello, everyone. My name is Nelson Mills. I'm a senior at Rice University and working in Dr. Mohit Kira's lab. And what our research is focusing on is, as I'm sure many of y'all have seen in your clinical practices, some patients come in with testosterone levels, you know, around 200, you get them up to 400, they feel great. Others come in, you know, with seemingly you going out of level somewhere around 400, 500, but they feel terrible. And you have to keep giving them T until they're around, you know, 800, 900 even. And so our thought was that there's this androgen receptor, or AR it's called, which is a protein that binds to DHT and controls a lot of those secondary sex characteristic genes. And so actually we found some amazing results that we're sharing here for the first time. And we found that for patients who are in that group where they have seemingly eugonadal levels or they need more T in general to feel better, they actually have much longer androgen receptors, which means that their androgen receptor basically is doing a worse job at binding to testosterone and making those secondary sex characteristics. So we're going to keep including more patients, but this is some really promising results. And, you know, hopefully in clinical practices, it'll be relevant in the next couple of years.
Well, that could absolutely revolutionize how we think about testosterone. Rather than focusing so much on the testosterone level, is what is that testosterone doing at the receptor?
Right.
So can anyone in the community test for this receptor?
Yeah, it's a super easy test. You know, it's just a PCR.
Yeah.
Same as getting a COVID test, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, in the future, it'd be great if you could make this a predictive model where a patient comes in, right? You check his T levels and they also say, hey, we're going to check your AR. And then, you know, if you see, hey, you got a really long AR, let's start you on a higher dose. Or, you know, eventually if we can get to that kind of clinical, you know, predictive model that, as you said, would totally revolutionize how we do TRT.
Wow, that's amazing. And you're a senior at Rice University. You're an undergrad.
Wow. But I've been working in his lab since freshman year on this project, actually. So it's been a long time coming. We're super happy to have some cool results finally.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing the exciting work that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Who we got next here?
My name's Arnav Walia. I'm a medical student at Rutgers in New Jersey. I'm between third and fourth year. I'm a dedicated researcher with Dr. Mo Kira at Baylor. And I'm really excited to be here. I just started with him a couple of months ago. And I'm working on a couple of very exciting projects, particularly in the space of Fronies and separately erectile dysfunction. We, with Dr. Kira, we're looking at a couple of projects. One is looking at like genetic predisposition to Fronies and, you know, certain markers that might indicate whether someone's a better candidate for treatments like Xiaflex. And then we have a couple of device companies we work with, particularly in the space of radiofrequency ablation, radiofrequency waves, for the treatment of Fronies. They're theorized to work by promoting vasculature growth in the superficial tissue. So we have a couple of clinical trials in the office. We're presenting on some of those here and at the upcoming conferences. And I'm very excited to just be involved with him.
Awesome. Now, what I love about that work, and I love working with companies that are really into device innovation, you know, we think that doing studies like this in clinical trials, hey, you know, like at the end of every retrospective study, the conclusion is, and we need prospective, randomized clinical trials to actually answer this question and not just generate a hypothesis. But, and I don't know how like involved you are in sort of like the day-to-day of that work, but how challenging is it to actually enroll patients in like a device trial?
It's fairly challenging. I mean, we're directly involved with, we recruit, we follow up with them at every appointment in the clinic. We speak with them, you know, even at their homes. It's pretty difficult. You know, not everybody's the best candidate. Sometimes it's difficult if somebody really wants it, but they might not qualify for, you know, whatever reasons. It's certainly like very interesting to me. I've never, you know, in a lot of places, you don't get really this kind of exposure that you do with Dr. Kira and the level of involvement he has with so many different, you know, companies and organizations. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I think that innovation comes about, right, when you combine sort of like the engineers and you combine like the clinicians, and that's where the magic happens, because none of us can do everything ourselves. The engineers don't have access to patients, yeah. right? And we don't know all the engineering behind some of these technologies. So love the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Awesome. Next up, who we got?
Hi, so my name is Peyton Cody. I am also a third-year medical student at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. And as well as Arnav, I'm also doing a dedicated research year with Dr. Kara. My project that I'm here talking about today is investigating CCH in the active phase of Peyronie's disease. We did a retrospective cohort study and built out a cohort of patients in the active phase and the stable phase, examined them, and what we saw was that they're demographically similar, and treatment-wise, they receive similar outcomes as the patients in the stable phase. And, you know, this is so important with therapies that, you know, as we gain more experience, we've had more time with them, expanding them to patient populations that they might not necessarily have been able to, so that more patients can receive such a great treatment and really just have some relief for such a devastating disease for a lot of people.
You're really hitting on a really important pain point, which is like the guy who comes in that's still in that act, like things are still changing when it comes to his Peyronie's, and he's kind of like, so what do I do? And we're like, oh, just wait for it to stabilize. What terrible advice. And yet all of our guidelines, you know, really just focus on pain control in the active phase. And then we'll do something about it once it stabilizes. And patients don't like hearing that. So this really takes a more proactive approach to say, while your body is changing, maybe we have that ability to change the trajectory of the disease process early on. I love that. And I think patients love that message.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing. Next up.
All right. We're going to tag team this one. I'll let Dr. Stocks introduce himself first.
Amy, thank you so much for having this opportunity. We're so excited that we love research so much and we have this opportunity to share everything we're doing at Baylor. Likewise, I was a Baylor trainee. I did my residency at Baylor. I trained with Larry Lipschultz, and fortunately, he let me stay on with his partner, which is crazy. That's a rare opportunity, but I feel so fortunate. So I'm faculty at Baylor now in our division of male reproductive medicine and surgery, which is awesome. So I'm just going to talk a little about my research. So basically, we know azoospermia or no sperm is a lot more common than we think. So 1% of all guys have no sperm, right? And we got to figure out why this is. So what we do in our lab is they see us, we get a semen sample, and we have that data that there's no sperm. And, you know, even us spinning it down into a small little pellet, us looking at it manually, we see no sperm, but what do we do? But I sort of thought, is a person looking at a sample really the best way to do this with all our new technologies of imaging, of AI, which is great, image analysis? So luckily at Baylor, we have this great core where we have these very expensive machines where I'm taking these samples down and say, are you truly azoospermic? Why don't we image every single cell and see if there's a sperm or not? Wow. So then basically we've collected almost 100 guys now that are azoospermic and looked at all those images. And I'm going to hand it off to Aiden, who's done the legwork on this.
Oh my God, like the cliffhanger.
I'm a cliffhanger, but he's been fabulous. I'm going to hand it off to Aiden, who's fabulous real quick.
Yeah, so I'm an MS3 at Baylor, and I work a lot with Dr. Stocks as well as Dr. Karen and Dr. Lipschultz. But so manually going through all these tiny cells takes forever. In fact, they've tried it. It takes over 8 hours of like man time to go through a single ejaculate. So what we do is taking those images from the flow cytometer that Dr. Stocks mentioned, we feed them to an algorithm that we created specifically for identifying sperm without the need for any sort of markers. Because, you know, if we want to use these down the line for IVF, if you add chemicals, markers, whatever, staining, it's not going to be a viable sperm. So we need a way to do this just using the picture. And we need to do it quickly because this is a rapid machine. In order to image so fast, it also has to spit them out very fast. So we need a decision very quickly. And we're actually writing up a manuscript right now going over the first results, but it's looking very promising. And we're finding, you know, sperm very quickly in a significant proportion of these men that were previously thought to be azoospermic.
Wow. So you had mentioned the use of AI. And so how does AI play a role in this technology?
So we get those images, right, from the flow cytometer. But it's tens and tens and even hundreds of thousands of images. So by the time the image is taken, we only have milliseconds before it comes out of the cytometer. So we need a program that can identify in those milliseconds, is this sperm or not, so that we can sort it appropriately eventually. So AI actually is able to look at these images and say, that's debris, that's a leukocyte, that's probably a sperm, we should shoot it out the other side, right?
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah.
And then just at the beauty of this conference, I am presenting this later, which is great, but not to give away the results, but we found 40% of guys that were told they don't have sperm do.
Oh my goodness.
Which is crazy. And that's going to change someone's complete life force, right?
Because what is it like when you have to sit down with someone and tell someone he has no sperm in the ejaculate? I don't know that I've actually ever had to have that conversation because my practice really doesn't really delve into male infertility, but I can't even imagine what that conversation looks like.
Yeah, it's the hardest conversation I have. Like, I literally before clinic prep myself of thinking about how we're going to deliver this and what are the next steps forward. And I think the beauty of our research consortium is we're working on the next step forward, right? So can we really truly say you have no sperm, or maybe there is a chance? So it's the hardest thing in my practice, but you know, it's important.
Wow.
Yeah.
So everything that you all have discussed is like practice changing. Oh my God. So we're going to have to stay tuned for like next year to SMSNA, because I'm sure we're going to have some great updates. The AUA coming up like in May, I'm sure you'll have some updates there. So what are like some of these other like lingering questions? Like what else are you guys curious about here?
Yeah, no. So one of my partners, he's not here right now, but Taylor Cohn, also a Baylor College of Medicine, not to be too nepotistic or anything, but he is looking at this really cool idea of, well, how do we predict non-invasively if a guy has sperm or even has early signs of ED? So we have this really cool new technology at Baylor that uses ultrasound, but it's high frequency ultrasound. So we're actually able to get really, really good resolution based on the images where we can actually see an individual tubule in the testicle to say, maybe there's sperm. Maybe these tubules in this area are bigger. Why don't we go after those? Or even to the ED question, let's actually measure the size of the vessels in the penis, right? We all know that ED precedes major cardiovascular events. What if this is a screening tool where we say, why don't we look at the arteries in your penis beforehand, and maybe this is, you're at higher cardiovascular risk. So that's another really exciting project we're working on, getting a lot of preliminary data on, and we're excited about.
Wow, I love that. So I feel like we need to end this by all putting like our hands in the middle and like doing like a 1, 2, 3, and we just entertain me like, 1, 2, 3. Woo! Thanks, folks, for tuning in.